Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association podcast entitled Identifying and Eliminating Bias in Immigration Proceedings. I'm J.J. Area, AOA's Education and Resources Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Brian M. Large, a member of the AILA Board of Governors and the AILA LGBT Working Group Chair from Denver, Colorado. Joining Brian is Natasha El-Sergani from Seattle, Washington, and Nash Fayad from Richmond, Virginia. The speakers have selected some written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AILA Agora Digital Library. Go to agora.aila.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file, and right above or below, a resources file. If you have any questions, you can email agora@aila.org. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Brian.
Hello, and thank you for joining us on this podcast. Today, we're discussing identifying and eliminating bias in immigration proceedings, and I am very pleased to have this panel put together to discuss these issues. First, we want to talk a little bit about what is bias in immigration law, and probably try to separate some of what we're talking about between discrimination and stereotypes and bias and the general things that we see in our practices as immigration lawyers. Oftentimes in immigration proceedings, we're facing different situations where an officer's bias or a judge's bias or a government attorney's bias is going to come into play. Some of it is natural, some of it is implied in the law, and some of it can be discriminatory, some of it is set up for national security reasons, and we want to have a very general discussion today about where we see bias in immigration law. And so I would turn over to Natasha or Nash and see where do you at times see bias play into our practices?
Well, first of all, I think bias is something could be close to be generic in immigration law, and especially because we are dealing basically with the immigrant community, and it's a minority. Newcomers always, anywhere they go, will face different kinds of bias and discrimination. I think any type of predisposed idea about someone, some ethnic, some group, gender, sex, against other group could be fit within the description of bias. In immigration, we see it in all kinds of areas. We see it in visa screening. We see it in immigration proceedings. We see it in the visa waiver given to different nationals from different countries, and we see it in determining also family immigration. So the issue of bias is very serious and of a concern in immigration law. So to answer your question, I think bias can be found in every area of immigration law.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think that a lot of it sometimes is just built into the nature of what we do. I think that oftentimes we even have biases about business immigration practices versus refugee practices or family-based practices and possibly within our clients themselves. And what sorts of things do we expect our clients, our business clients, to do or not do? You know, it comes from some biases that we as practitioners even have developed over time in our practices. I think that it's not unusual for immigration to have some of those similar types of biases. And I think that in general, we see a need for more diversity and more inclusion in the practice of immigration law on the attorney side, also on the government side. I think that those sorts of things will go to contribute to the overall bias issues that are happening in immigration law.
And I would just add to that that the bias definitely comes up with law enforcement. So when it comes to removal proceedings versus people applying for affirmative applications, folks who would be picked up for kind of minor crimes and then processed into the immigration system may be more likely to find themselves in that situation if they're of a particular race or speak a certain language that would make police officers believe that they're immigrants versus other immigrants.
Yeah, I mean, do we see in our practices at times where somebody might get an ICE hold put on them because they're from one specific nationality or another, or because their name singles them out as possibly being a foreigner? Is that something that we normally see in our practices?
Yes, we do, and actually sometimes goes to a more radical scenario. Every once in a while, you would hear that a U.S. citizen was held by ICE because they thought that he is a foreign national, and just because they look Latinos and crossing the border, and at that time they forgot to have their ID with them.
Correct. Yeah, I certainly have had foreign national clients who I thought, you know, might have a problem where they would end up with an ICE hold and didn't, and you know, it would be people with last names that wouldn't necessarily single them out as being a foreigner. And then, Nash, you're absolutely correct. It's you know, definitely have had calls into the office saying, you know, my family member has an ICE hold, but they were born here, and so then we've got to start doing some digging and some work to get the immigration hold lifted there.
And there's certainly intersections of categories of folks that will be singled out more dramatically, such as Central Americans who have tattoos, for example, who don't have any criminal history, may be told that they're associated or at risk of being affiliated with a gang, and that can be a reason for someone to then be processed by ICE, whereas a lot of times I've seen a couple of cases where we've run criminal background checks on these folks and they don't have any criminal history. So it's purely based on an assumption made based on tattoos that somebody has.
Yeah, I think
and
tattoos
being a young Hispanic male.
Absolutely. I think tattoos is a great way to see where there's bias that's not necessarily related to a race or a national origin background. I think the tattoos themselves tend to give off some sort of a presumption that maybe further investigation is needed or warranted. And I know that we see this problem a lot in Ciudad Juarez when people show up to their medical exams and have tattoos. Last fall, the Latin American and Caribbean chapter had a conference down in Rio, and a consular officer came out to speak to us, and the question was posed to him, how do you handle tattoos? And the officer there almost thought it was funny because he just said, everybody's got tattoos these days. And, you know, basically said tattoos are a non-issue in Rio. So I think that, you know, this bias comes into play in certain posts where they're maybe a little more hypersensitive to gang activity or gang issues. And I think that that brings us to our next issue here is these sorts of biases play into how decisions are made, but there's definitely national security issues that need to be taken into account. And when we're talking about gang activity coming up from Central America and Mexico, or whether we're talking about potential threats to national security by terrorism out of the Middle East or other parts of the world, at what point are these biases genuine national security issues, and at what point do they become just pure discrimination? What are we looking at as far as are we implementing these biases based on national origin, based on religion, based on America's experience with admitting people from certain nationalities or from certain cultures, and how do we see national security issues play out?
Well, as you said, you know, it's a kind of balancing act between wanting to be a humanitarian country that's assisting people who are going through very rough conditions in their home countries. But oftentimes, people suffering from the same gang activity or terrorist attacks that the U.S. is concerned about who are trying to leave their countries then get targeted themselves as if being of that national origin or religion makes them more likely to be suspect when they're coming to our country. So a good example would be what's been in the news lately with governors who called for state bans of refugees from Syria once there was a huge surge of folks leaving. There are about 13 million displaced Syrians right now. And while countries like Canada have chosen to be more explicitly welcoming and making room for 25,000 new refugees, the U.S. has been resistant in many ways to that. And there's been a lot of political rhetoric that calls for bans on Muslims that seems to be very plainly unconstitutional and based on nothing more than national origin or religion and not based on somebody who's already going to go through an extensive background check.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to see even certain presidential candidates saying, you know, we would admit any Christian Syrians, but we would not admit any Muslim Syrians or, you know, and all that does really is just foment this bias that where it does turn into discrimination. And, a statement like that tends to blanket all Muslim Syrians as being terrorists and blanket all Christian Syrians as not being a threat to national security in the United States or not potentially being a criminal issue or something like that. Simply because they happen to be of the same faith as a presidential candidate or their followers. And so I think that sort of activity only increases the amount of bias and discrimination that we find in our immigration system. Some areas... go ahead, Nash.
I'm sorry. Yeah, absolutely. I could add here also that the media sometimes adds to the factor of bias when they talk about events or dangerous activities and add to it a religion or a national origin. National security is a very, very important and sensitive matter and should not be compromised in any way. However, when the issue of national security gets mixed up with labeling religions or people from different origins, then you create this area of bias that may affect the judgment in effectively fighting in the area of national security. We want it or not, the reality is every time you are talking about people coming from, immigrants coming from Mexico and Central America, there is bias toward the possibility of being gang members or drug traffickers. When you talk about people coming from the Middle East, based on the way immigration deals with things, statistics show that it will be sort of a bias, or they will be predisposed toward some elements of possible terrorism or radicalism, fraud, some areas in Africa. Family fraud, some areas in East Europe. So it becomes really a challenge how we could protect the nation, how we could tighten the national security without going into the area of bias. I think is a challenge, but this is an area that, in my opinion, should be a lot more to be done.
And so, Nash, you bring up a really interesting issue with, we'll take fraud out of Africa as an example, or fraud out of Eastern Europe. It's an area that immigration officials seem to find a high incidence of fraud. When you have a client come in that is the spouse of a U.S. citizen, and they're from one of these countries that we generally feel like they're scrutinized more heavily because of fraud issues, what are you doing in your practice about that? What is it? What steps are you taking with the client, or what is your thought process? How are you preparing for this bias that you already know exists out there?
Well, first thing, I share this information with them, because I believe that if I share this information with them, if I explain to them there is a possibility of an extra scrutiny of the relationship, for example, in the family contest, it will alert them to the fact that they need to take it serious and they need to do some extra efforts to maybe build the case in a different way than another person from a region that, in my opinion, immigration doesn't look at as a possible fraud. So I think the best way is to make the client aware of the challenge here, whether they are coming from Saudi Arabia for any possible business, or whether they are coming from Yemen because they are a child of a U.S. citizen, or they are coming from Ukraine as the fiancé of a U.S. citizen. I think this is the best way to deal with it.
And Natasha, do you have anything to add on that? Are you letting your clients know about the potential for fraud findings or fraud investigations, and how are your clients responding to you on that?
Absolutely. I think most of our clients here are from Central America, and there's a very widespread. It's very widely known that folks from Mexico find it especially hard to win asylum cases. And there's an issue of notario fraud where folks will go to see people who aren't attorneys, and they'll basically be given a story that they can tell and get themselves into a lot of trouble because the person is trying to exploit them and have them pay money to basically win a fraudulent asylum claim. But the issue that we've seen here, we've had to kind of clean up after cases like that. But in terms of bias, I would say there is a bias against Mexican immigrants being able to win asylum, and advising people that they're going to need to bring in extra proof and prepare extra carefully to reinforce the claims that they have, whether or not they're going to succeed, because sometimes people just don't fit into, the particular social group that they need to. But I think just in those situations, yes, it's really important to inform the client that they need to be extra prepared and spend time with you, telling you all of the details about their case and backing them up as much as possible.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that telling clients about what could possibly happen or why immigration believes that incidents of fraud are more prevalent from some countries, I think that when my clients from these countries come in, I'm very thorough with them and explain to them there, you know, in Denver, we seem to see a lot of investigation on Peruvian marriages, for example. And so, you know, if I get a Peruvian client come into my office, I'm going to tell them, you know, they scrutinize Peruvian marriages a lot. And, you know, we're going to want to take some extra steps here. We're going to want to go above and beyond to demonstrate that this is a bona fide marriage. You know, whereas if I had a Canadian national in my office marrying a U.S. citizen, I think that we'll probably, you know, obviously we're going to have the bona fide marriage evidence, but we're not going to take any extra steps anticipating a fraud investigation in a case like that. You know, I think that it's good for practitioners to be aware of where these areas are where immigration tends to find more fraud and to be able to hit these issues head on. I know some practitioners don't necessarily want to face that head on or supplement the record with any additional evidence ahead of time. And I think that in general, it's a practice preference. It just happens to be the way that I practice. And, you know, I would prefer to go in and show immigration what we have. I feel mostly like an adjudicator might review a file before the interview and come up with their biases ahead of time. And so if I've got enough in the file before the interview, I feel like my interview might go more smoothly. It's obviously not scientific or anything, but that's my general feeling as a practitioner.
Yeah, and I can see where they, why they would try to maybe not go and into these areas because, you know, as funny as it may sound, because of our experience with different areas of bias against different immigrants, we become sort of biased in the way how we ask our clients yeah. questions to prep them. But I think it is a necessary measure. It's a good bias if you are here, because this way we can sort of prevent things to happen. And I know Natasha mentioned the issue of Latino clients. It's for example, when in 601As, we are facing a lot of times when people go to their posts, to the U.S. posts in their countries, they are scrutinized a lot on possibility of entering the United States more than one time, mm-hmm. where you are not going to be facing this if somebody coming from South Africa. They're not going to be swimming all the way here. And sometimes it becomes a big challenge, and we even had a situation where someone's passport once was stolen, and then somebody crossed the border with it, and they didn't know about it, and it took months and months and months to convince the government that, in fact, this person didn't leave the United States and re-enter, but somebody stole his passport.
Yeah, those are difficult issues to combat, especially when you're dealing with a consulate that's difficult to communicate with just by the nature of how that system is set up. And not allowing attorneys in, it's difficult to overcome those issues from time to time. When we get into talking then about bias and possibly into discrimination based on age or gender, where do we see that in the visa process? What's been your experiences in gender biases or age biases in visa screening? In some countries, I will see gender bias based on whether or not to issue visas for certain categories. I know in my practice, I've seen a lot. I've seen more incidents of fraud, actually, with regard to gender, where somebody may have claimed to have been married or may have claimed to not be married so that they could get their visa. When we're looking in general at people coming to the United States as tourists, it seems as though some countries are more likely to issue visas to maybe a single mother, whereas a single mother of a different nationality or applying at a different post may have a difficult or impossible time trying to get a tourist visa coming to the United States. I think that those issues tend to create a significant amount of problems for somebody coming to the United States, and we'll end up seeing more fraud due to some of those biases sometimes. But does somebody, Does the fact that somebody's a single parent mean that they're more likely to immigrate to the United States, that they more likely have immigrant intent and not want to issue that non-immigrant visa? How often do you all see that in your practice?
Well, it depends also on the region. We see lots of gender bias. And as you said, for example, a single mother or a young female is more likely than with a young male to be denied a visa from certain regions or certain countries than others. Gender bias could be also depending on where you are from. For example, if it's a male coming from a Muslim country, it would be more scrutinized, let's say, somebody from Yemen, because they consider it a high fraud post. It may be scrutinized more than the women on the possibility of being married to more than one woman at the same time, because it's legal in the country. Versus if this is a woman, less likely to be scrutinized or biased against in this area, because the practice is of a male to have more than one female spouse at the same time and not the contrary. So it's really depend on what region or what religion, and we see lots of bias in these areas.
I agree with that. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I haven't seen it in that area specifically, but more kind of in the U visa and VAWA context, where we'll be interviewing new clients, and there may be a potential more to screen single women for previous domestic abuse that may make them eligible for some form of relief rather than men. And then that can extend in removal proceedings for asylum claims where there is sexual abuse or other kinds of abuse that a male has experienced. They may feel less comfortable sharing that information with everyone from the initial asylum officer to the attorney to the judge. And I think it's really important to work against those biases and realize that the reality is that domestic violence and other forms of gender violence happen to men as well, and make sure that you're looking at things kind of holistically and taking into account a person's own discomfort within their own culture, whether it's Latin America or the Middle East or countries where traditionally it's less favored upon, you know, for someone to report something like that, and making sure that you maybe do a little education with your pre-hearing statement, even just talking about cultural norms, and also educating the judge and having the client themselves talk about, you know, what is it like in your country if you share information about something like this, just so that you're giving context to a level of discomfort with sharing information that could end up disrupting someone's ability to represent and advocate for themselves.
I think that the VAWA issue that you touched on is a really important issue, because in the way that you described it there, I think that even our clients have a bias, some sort of inherent bias about who can apply for VAWA benefits or whether even a benefit might be available, particularly to male victims. You know, I think that as attorneys, I'm not certain that attorneys, that we're always screening as well for VAWA issues when we're doing intakes, when our client is a male as opposed to a female. And sometimes explaining the VAWA process, explaining the standards in the law to a male client might help to develop a VAWA case there that might already exist, but that the client may not know that they're eligible for, or that the attorney might not have spotted in the first few minutes of an intake. I don't know that I have many male VAWA clients that come in and say, hey, I was the victim of domestic violence. Can I do something? Mm-hmm. But in talking to clients and asking them about their history and their marital history, their relationship, I think that a lot of these, I tend to have a large number of male VAWA clients. I still have more women than men, but I think that the number of male clients I have is much higher than many of my colleagues. And I frequently wonder whether or not attorneys screen very well for that in general, particularly when it comes to male victims. And some of this is built into the language of the law itself. VAWA obviously is the Violence Against Women Act. It doesn't exactly scream male applicant. It's difficult sometimes to convince a male client that they can go ahead and apply for this benefit. I think that some of my male clients have actually shown that they may not want to apply for this, or they don't really want to go on the record of having been a victim of domestic violence. And I think, Natasha, you were correct in that a lot of this ends up being cultural bias or some sort of cultural stigma to be the male and be the victim of abuse, whether it be physical abuse or emotional cruelty, and then to go into a government office and ask for these benefits, basically telling strangers and officers your story of being a victim of abuse. I think another place where we see some legislated bias, we see Congress from time to time come out with what seems to be some national security issues addressed, but like in the NSEERS program or in the recent program to exclude people from the visa waiver program if they visited certain countries. Generally, they're working off of statistics and known threats of national security, but we do see that some of this stuff ends up legislated. Do either of you have any comments on that?
Sure, yeah. This is take us sort of back to the national security versus discrimination. Visa waiver, I think you were talking about the H.R. 158 that was enacted by Congress in the 114th session. But as you said, we had other practices before. After the terrorist attacks of September 11, we had the NSEERS, where 26 countries were of concern, and the immigration was dealing with nationals from these countries in a different way, or visiting them or checking their visas more than others. Again, the national security is a very important area, but it is very important to deal with national security on an equal basis. If you are dealing with any area of national security, that specific area should be dealt with different people from different origins or religions the same way. Let's take the visa waiver country issue now. We have four countries put on or nationals of European countries or visa waiver countries who visited certain countries, Syria, Iraq, Sudan, and was it Iran?
I think correct.
Iran,
yeah.
Too. Mm-hmm. Or they are originally from there. Now, it's creating a big problem, especially for example, somebody who's coming to invest in the United States. What is the likelihood this person will be scrutinized because they are from Belgium, but at the same time, they happen to have their parents from Syria, or they visited Syria because they're originally from there.
Or maybe they work for a petroleum company they have to visit the Middle East for some reason.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And there's another problem. As soon as the Congress enacted had the intention to enact this H.R. 158, the European community immediately said that they are going to treat the visa waiver for the United States the same way. And that will create, I don't know how that's going to play in the future, or anybody knows how that is playing now, it immediately creates a bias toward Americans who are originally from these countries too. And all of a sudden, U.S. Citizens who are nationals of Iran or of Iranian origin or Syrian origin become a second-hand visa waivers in going to Europe or to go into these visa waiver countries that we have any visa waiver relationship with. So it doesn't even only create bias toward immigrants who are going to come to the United States, but it creates a potential bias against different U.S. Citizens.
Agreed, very much agreed on that. And when we talk about like the visa waiver program, here's another area where I think that we see some legislated bias. We have certain countries that are designated as being able to come to the United States without needing a visa. Obviously, this program is set up to help promote tourism in the United States and to allow easier access to the United States for nationals of certain countries that have low incidence of immigration violations. This appears to be a statistical analysis or a mathematical analysis by immigration authorities. Do we see this as a problem? Do we see a bias here? Is this appropriate or inappropriate?
I think that there's a strong relationship between who can participate in that program and who the U.S. has friendly political relationships with. Following 9/11 and during the Iraq War, President Bush expanded the visa waiver program to include countries that were assisting in the war effort. And so it almost seemed like this kind of exchange, military assistance would equal a more friendly co-relationship between two countries. And so it wasn't really based on, you know, the merits of someone being able to come, but based on these other things. And that extends to today with these four countries that are being excluded. Some people wonder why certain countries aren't included that, you know, may have raised the same national security concerns for the U.S., but because the United States has particular kinds of relationships with them, they're not going to want to exclude those citizens from coming and visiting.
And I think it's very important here to mention that statistics, I guess, it should be the key for doing anything in immigration. When, for example, Argentina used to be on the list of visa waivers, and then they took it out of the visa waiver program, it was statistically based on the fact that the economy declined there and more Argentinians would maybe violate the visa regime, the tourist visa regime, than the norm that will allow nationals of one country to be on the visa waiver. And based on the statistics, immigration came up with this, or the Department of State came up with, the decision taking Argentina from the visa waiver countries. And when things are built on statistics, I think it's acceptable, and this is what the government should be doing.
And there are certainly a lot of political questions there as well. But yes, I think that looking at the statistics and the incidence of immigration violations is an important tool to looking at that. I think that continuing the visa waiver program is helpful to, in building these relationships, and I also think that the officers are supposed to be screening upon entry as well, and can easily send somebody back to their home country. Do we see possibly that it's easier to get into the U.S. As a visa waiver participant than it is to acquire a B2 visa in non-visa waiver countries? I think that one of the issues I have is that I think it's a little bit more difficult for an officer at an airport to turn somebody around than it is for an officer at a consulate to simply say no. What has been your guys' experiences on that? I guess maybe otherwise stated, are there certain countries when you have a client going to apply for a B2 visa, are there certain countries where you're having a more difficult time trying to convince the consulate of non-immigrant intent, whereas that same person, if they were allowed onto the plane, might be able to convince a CBP officer of that much easier?
Well, I guess there are more denials in consulates than people return from airports, obviously because a lot more people come and apply in a consulate than after receiving a visa, people will commit to enter the United States. But I think there are more, in my practice, more cases of people over-scrutinized at the border or at the post of entry than someone asked to come back to the consulate and have their visa revoked. You know what I'm saying? Like, once the consulate issues somebody a visa, they most likely, finish their job here. But even after people are scrutinized in the consulate, when they attempt to enter, they are scrutinized again. And here, I think we see more people return back after were given visas than a consulate going and saying, "Oh, we made a mistake. You know, can you come back to the consulate? We need to talk to you." And then they end up canceling their visas.
Do you find that in some countries more than others? Even, take South America, for example. I mean, would you find that a B2 is going to be more difficult to get in somewhere like Ecuador than it might be in somewhere like Argentina?
Well, I don't know in this region now, but I can tell you that recently, because of the problems in Syria, I've seen consulates calling people of Syrian origin, like Syrian nationals, to come back, and especially in Gulf countries, and then they will go there and they will tell them, we're revoking your visas. And I think this is biased toward what's happening now in Europe, or the wave of refugees, unscreened refugees.
Absolutely.
Sort of the whole atmosphere and what the media is talking about the Syrians being a threat.
Right. Absolutely. I want to turn our focus now a little bit on detention and issues related to detention. There are frequently policy issues related to who's detained and where they're detained. I know in Denver, we're less, and I think in a lot of parts of the country, we're less likely to see a young mother with young children detained, if at all possible. Our bed space in our local facility for females is much smaller than our bed space for male detainees. Are we seeing gender biases in who's held in detention and who's released, and are these are they reasonable? Is it good policy? Is it good humanitarian policy? And does that overcome whatever sort of discriminatory effect it has on other people not in similar circumstances?
Well, there's a preference for releasing people who have family members, and definitely I would say that it's easier to get somebody released who's a woman, who has children, who's married, than a single young man who doesn't have any connections to the country. And I guess there's the reasoning behind that is that, you know, someone with more connections is more likely to appear for future proceedings and less of a flight risk. But it does seem problematic that, you know, perhaps more sympathy or lenience is given to a woman than a man who's not married. Or, you know, what if this person is an LGBT person who either can't have a family or has chosen not to? And we see that with even things like DAFA, which doesn't actually cover folks like that as well. But in the detention context, yeah, I'd say the familial relationships that are called for as positive factors for someone getting released can lead to certain gender bias.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. And I think some of that takes us back to, especially talking about DACA, for example, you know, or the DAPA program that's on hold right now. You know, I have a very large number of LGBT clients who, in most cases, will never qualify for the DAPA program because most of my clients don't have children. And that's just the nature of who they are. And yes, I think that some of that is, you know, although that's not legislated, it's, you know, kind of fits within that legislated bias category about how our programs are set up to sometimes intentionally and sometimes very unintentionally, but protect some groups of people over others. You know, I know recently in the LGBT working group, the issue of trans detention came up, and I know, Natasha, you've done quite a bit of work in this area as well. Do you want to speak a little bit about detention of transgender people and how some of the biases in immigration are playing out in the real world in that scenario?
Sure. So for transgender detainees, sometimes they'll be detained in the housing unit that corresponds with the sex they were assigned at birth rather than the sex that they choose, and that can raise all kinds of issues with potential sexual abuse or harassment. But the solution to that by immigration detention facilities has too often been to put somebody into what basically equates to solitary confinement. It's called, you know, a SHU. It's a secured housing unit, or I think that's right. And so people are held in these conditions that amount to solitary confinement, and the justification is that it's, quote, for their own good, and that it's protecting them from violence. But a lot of human rights groups have come out with research that pretty solidly says that solitary confinement basically amounts to torture and will drive even the most sane, mentally healthy person to a level of mental illness after a certain amount of time. So a lot of advocates are calling for, you know, different things, the end of solitary confinement based on how someone identifies, and also just calling for LGBT immigrants not to be detained, which, you know, could raise another problem of special treatment for LGBT immigrants, you know, not being detained versus other folks being detained. But I think the larger issue that's kind of overshadowing all of this is that we have immigration detention facilities that are often run by private contractors, and the two biggest ones in the U.S. that we have are GEO and Corrections Corporations of America. And these are organizations that basically profit from how many people are in detention centers. So the problem of mass detention in and of itself kind of creates these issues where you have workers who are, or you have people running these facilities who are thinking with a corporate mindset of how to cut costs, and that ends up kind of slashing appropriate medical care and appropriate personnel to thoughtfully and carefully manage issues like this, and also this leaves room for a lot of holes in accountability. So it kind of all ties in with this larger overarching issue, in my opinion. But
do you think we'd still have transgender detention issues do you think we would still be facing these if ICE were running the facilities rather than private corporations?
I think we would, but at least there would be mechanisms to complain and advocate on behalf of folks. I feel that, and a lot of other advocates feel, that when things are profit-driven, they're inherently going to be less they're going to be held less accountable than a government entity would. And so, in my opinion, I do think that it would be an improvement if ICE was handling it and if it was appropriately funded to handle things like that. And if, you know, there were more, I mean, it also comes to comprehensive immigration reform, right? If we had less people being rounded up for detention, then there would be more resources to handle, you know, those cases where people did need to be detained in a more humane way.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think this is one area where ICE could benefit from more diversity and inclusion within their own agency as well. I think that if they had people on the inside that knew and understood these issues better, some of the actions that ICE takes, or possibly the for-profit companies running the detention centers, I think that some of these issues could be more appropriately addressed if they were implementing better diversity programs within. You know, recently we saw with trans detention, for example, there was a big outcry about detaining LGBT people, and ICE's response was, great, well, then we'll just have a facility for LGBT people, and wanted to move everybody out to California. And then, you know, without understanding or fully understanding the problem they were about to cause, there was this big uproar from a lot of organizations, including AILA, crying out at the fact that we're segregating LGBT people into a facility in California. It doesn't matter where they're from. We're removing them from their loved ones, from their attorneys, from, you know, possibly even a change in the law based on the circuit. And I think that was somewhat of a knee-jerk reaction from the agency, not able to fully understand the problem that they were about to cause there, but trying to make a solution for another problem, and that's the solitary confinement issue there. So, very good. We have about 8 minutes left here, and I want to speak really briefly on the refugee issue. And we touched on this a little while ago, but you know, Natasha, I think that you had mentioned about states trying to block refugees from coming into their states, and what authority do governors have? There obviously was a large number of governors saying, you know, we don't want refugees from certain countries in our state. What is the role of the state in choosing which refugees land in their state?
It's my understanding that there are a lot of state-funded resources for refugee resettlement. So defunding those was part of some of the initiatives that the governors were proposing. But ultimately, it's, you know, not a state and local decision who's admitted into the border. But these kind of initiatives to make states less welcoming to refugees do seem to have, you know, some impact. But
yeah, I agree, and I think that there's been a lot of negative attention in the media about refugees coming to the United States, and we're even seeing that with the wave of refugees coming across the southern border, where, you know, they're seemingly played out in the media as being economic refugees or people coming here to work. And I think the question comes up is, are they being treated the same as other refugees that we're accepting through other means? I tend to think that the way that our system right now is set up is that people are being run through a very, very quick system along the southern border to try to determine whether they have valid asylum claims in the United States or not. And our program right now calls for reviewing those cases, but frequently in detention settings, before deciding whether or not somebody's got a valid claim to be in the United States. Do either of you have anything that you want to add on that issue?
I think the most important thing in here is to go back to the question of federal versus state. When the comprehensive immigration reform was debated, the conversation was, if the Congress doesn't enact and adopt a comprehensive immigration reform, the states are going to start having their own sort of rules and laws. And this is exactly what happened, and it forced the administration to do sort of their own executive orders on immigration. I think with refugees, and in order to eliminate bias, I think we need to take this debate back to the Congress and to make it again a federal issue, because it is a federal issue. And the least the states get involved in it, I think the better, because this is an area where it's inherently, this is a federal area, not a state area.
Absolutely, absolutely agreed. I think that Congress needs to take a more in-depth look at how refugees are being treated, and understand the laws that have been passed by previous Congresses, and by the rulings that have come out of the various courts. And get a better education on that issue in particular. And then in the last couple of minutes that we have left, Natasha, you had spoken earlier about when you're getting ready for a removal case that you're going to want to educate your judge and have them understand the cultural biases or cultural issues, things like that, that making sure that the court is well aware. What has been the experience in general with the two of you as far as how's the best way to go about educating your judge? Or what do you do when you're in court and you realize, oh, this judge doesn't understand this issue? At one point I had a transgender client in an asylum case who really could not wrap his mind around the fact that a young boy might have exerted some female tendencies or female behavior as a child and was abused over that. And this judge just really could not wrap his mind around the fact that a little boy might be acting like a little girl, and it was a very, very troublesome moment for me in the courtroom. What happens when you see some sort of a bias coming out of a judge, or what's the best thing to do at that point?
I think bringing in an expert can be very helpful in those situations. Who can talk about these things in as neutral and objective a way as possible, and make it, maybe liken it to other things that a judge might understand, other kinds of bias or forms of gender expression that the judge might understand, and making sure to contextualize moments like that with written materials that, give a broader understanding of how gender expression typically works. And I guess just making it as scientific as possible so that you have in the record evidence that if you need to bring up on appeal, you can say, we presented evidence that, this, and this is typical of somebody who's growing up and identifying in a certain way, and that was not taken into account by a judge, but at least it's there in the record. And then just in the courtroom, I think it just gives somebody who's unfamiliar with a certain issue kind of a pathway to begin to understand the issue. And hopefully, you know, the more that they see an issue like that, some biases are never going to go away, but I think it's always worth the effort to assume that, you know, if somebody doesn't know much about this particular minority, I mean, it comes up with language issues, too. If someone speaks, you know, a very remote dialect of Mam, and they're from Guatemala, and just researching it yourself to see how much you can, as much as you're never going to eliminate a bias, right? But trying to neutralize the impact of that and make it known in the courtroom that this is something that's making the client more vulnerable, to try to bring it up to a level where they have, hopefully, you know, the ideal is the same chance as everybody else.
And are you finding that judges are receptive to that?
Not always. And I've seen government attorneys, you know, kind of viciously cross-examine a client who's a male client who had been sexually abused as a child, and, you know, kind of drilling in with him, you know, why didn't you tell your wife before? And, you know, to try to repair that, you know, bringing up that in that particular environment, it would have been very difficult to admit these things or confess these things to even an intimate partner. So not always, but I think the client will appreciate that advocacy, and it could be the thing that ultimately makes them more credible in the end.
Very good. Well, with that, I think that ends our discussion today on identifying and eliminating bias in immigration proceedings. I think that it's a problem that's inherently based in our system, and that it's an issue that we will have to continue to address in our cases over time, as far as educating everybody in the system, educating our own attorneys on our side, educating ICE and the courts and USCIS, and I think that educating members of Congress on these issues is important as well. And so with that, I will turn it back over to JJ.
Thanks, Brian. For those of you who will be seeking CLE credit for your participation in this podcast, please make note of the following four-digit attendance verification code. The four-digit code is 4126. Again, the code is 4126. Please visit AILA's Web CLE Center at www.ailawebcle.org to record your CLE credit. Thank you very much to all of our speakers for sharing their knowledge and expertise, and to you for joining us today. That concludes our podcast.